KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Coming up, hard times in the newspaper business. Layoffs, buyouts, consolidations. What happens if print news just fades away?
You know, any idiot with a laptop can post his rambling. So there, in my opinion, it's so much nonsense. And there's no editor. So that's the beauty of a newspaper. There's an editor.
Also, why Western writer Wallace Stegner fled California.
He watches the land around him, Los Altos Hills, Silicon Valley, grow up into sort of this hodgepodge of development that sort of crowds him out. And in the end, he couldn't deal with change.
Those stories plus Shakespeare at San Quentin Prison and landscape gardens at Alcatraz. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. Remember the old joke, what's black and white and red all over? The answer, of course, newspapers. Problem is, these days, newspapers are not being read all over. In fact, readership for most papers is down, way down. The pain was felt in newsrooms across the state this week, from the San Jose Mercury News to the LA Times and the Long Beach Press-Telegram. In a few minutes, we'll hear what Californians are saying about the demise of their newspapers. But first, LA Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports on how the economic downturn, lost ad revenue, and the Internet are changing the news business.
For as long as he can remember, 28-year-old Brent Hopkins wanted to be a journalist. He was the editor of his high school newspaper. He wrote for UCLA's Daily Bruin, and on his last day of college, he drove his car from campus straight to his first job, working a night shift for the LA Daily News. After 7 years, though, Hopkins has seen the paper go through a series of cutbacks. The most recent one was last Friday.
And the editor called us all together and told us that there were going to be 22 layoffs out of 122 by Friday. And if anyone wanted to come forward, that they had until noon the next day to do so.
Hopkins volunteered to leave. He figured he's still young enough to start his career over by doing something he loves.
If I'm going to walk away from this job that I find so fulfilling, I didn't want to go do something where I felt like I was giving up. I wanted to go do something that was hard.
Hopkins chose one of the most thankless, difficult jobs out there. But more on that later. First, let's talk about the wave of newsroom cuts across the state and nation by looking at another newspaper that announced more cuts this week, the LA Times. Kevin Roderick runs the popular LA media blog, LA Observed. Roderick says many at the Times aren't sure what to make of Sam Zell, the billionaire who recently took over Times' corporate parent, Tribune Company.
I first heard that there were, you know, the wariness, okay, from the old-timers, and then the young-timers thinking, well, you know, maybe he's a breath of fresh air.
Roderick says the opinion soured last month after Zell toured the newsrooms of the TV stations and newspapers around the country that he had just bought. At a meeting with staff of the Orlando Sentinel, which was captured on video, Zell summed up his business model.
I want to make enough money so I can afford you. It's really that simple, okay? You need to, in effect, help me by being a journalist that focuses on what our readers want.
When a photographer responded by telling Zell that readers want puppy dogs, Zell told her she was being arrogant and ended his statement by saying, F you. He actually used the entire four-letter word. This tense exchange symbolizes the battles being fought at newspapers throughout the country over how to grow readership and generate ad revenue in an industry that has been redefined by the Internet. Former Times editor James O'Shea says giving readers what they want is not the solution.
Give them a range of news. And they can decide what they want to read. But don't ask them because they don't know. That's kind of like going to the doctor and saying to the doctor, you know, I got a stomach ache, and the doctor saying to you, what do you think is wrong with you?
O'Shea was fired in January for refusing to make newsroom cuts. He was the third editor to leave in 3 years, all for the same reason. Since Tribune took over the Times 8 years ago, the paper has cut more than 300 of its news staff. Now, Zell and the rest of Tribune management have hinted they want to cut foreign news bureaus. Times reporter Henry Weinstein recalls a conversation he and other reporters had with a Tribune executive who suggested readers could get foreign news from popular websites instead.
And we asked him where. He said Yahoo and Google, as if this news was being produced by an elf rather than Yahoo and Google aggregating it from people like our reporters who are out risking their lives in Afghanistan and Iraq and Colombia and places like that. I mean, it's the most absurd notion imaginable.
Weinstein has been with the LA Times for 30 years. He's one of the most accomplished reporters at the paper, where he regards his co-workers as family. One of them became family. He met his wife there. Weinstein was one of more than 30 reporters who volunteered this week to take a buyout. But while many on the Times' third-floor newsroom were shedding tears for their losses this week, two floors up on the Times' fifth-floor home to its website, the mood couldn't be more different. Meredith Artley, the new head of LATimes.com, works on an email. Behind her stands a bottle of champagne. She and her staff just celebrated 100 million page views in February, up 34% from last year.
I believe that when you have success, you need to celebrate it. So we had a case of champagne and a little toast and then went back to work.
While the Times print edition is shrinking, its website is growing, and Artley is leading the way. Artley says she has dozens of video cameras waiting to be used by Times reporters. She's already gotten newsroom staff to start blogging and sending web-exclusive updates on stories they're working on.
It's just a better way to get your story out there. So if you think about working for both mediums, for the newspaper and the website, then that's really what, isn't that what all journalists should be doing? Shouldn't we all be thinking about the best ways to tell our story regardless of the medium?
When viewers of its website are taken into account, the Times has actually grown its readership in recent years, despite a sharp decline in circulation. The problem is that advertisers are pulling out of the print edition and going online, where ad rates are much lower. Flex Your Power, one of the state's biggest advertisers, has done just that. But curiously, the ad giant has continued to run print ads in the foreign language press. While larger papers lose staff, smaller foreign language papers continue to thrive. For example, Orange County's Little Saigon neighborhood, population 150,000, has 43 local newspapers. But that's not helping Brent Hopkins, the young reporter from the Daily News who just volunteered to leave his paper. He doesn't speak Vietnamese, and he's already made the decision to leave journalism for a much more physically grueling job. He reads a list of his new job requirements.
25 to 30 reps for push-ups three times. 35 to 40 reps of sit-ups three times.
Hopkins is training to become a cop. He'll join the LAPD Police Academy at the end of the month. He says he wants to continue to make a difference in the world. And the writing? He's confident he'll continue to write, but he says he'll miss being a journalist. After all, it's something he had always wanted to be. For the California Report, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
All those problems at the LA Times raise a few questions, like, who's reading newspapers these days anyway? And do people who don't read them care if they just fade away? We started our search for answers at Ritual Cafe in San Francisco's hip Mission District this week. It's 11 a.m. and the place is packed. I'd say two-thirds of the customers have laptops open. One of them, dressed in a bright green hoodie, is 24-year-old Chelsea Bass. Not surprisingly, she says she gets most of her news online.
Do you ever read newspapers either online or, you know, with the actual paper?
I used to love to read newspapers. One of my favorite things is Sunday morning to have a newspaper. But just at the moment where I am in my life, I don't get the newspaper every day unless I buy it. I will go back to newspapers when I get a house and when it's thrown at the front door, and that's the way I'll read the news.
Ben Salinas is a 21-year-old student from Boston.
There's something about a newspaper that lets you carry it around, that lets you cut something out. It's a very different interaction than the internet is.
Across town, a few blocks from the San Francisco Giants ballpark, it's lunchtime in South Park. John Gatewood is sitting quietly at a bench reading the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah, I'm a dying breed. I know. I'm reading a daily newspaper.
Gatewood works for a graphic arts company. His father and grandfather both worked in the newspaper industry. But even this traditional news guy admits the internet helps keep him current, too, with this caveat.
There's so much crap online. You know, any idiot with a laptop can post his rambling. So, in my opinion, it's so much nonsense. And there's no editor. So that's the beauty of a newspaper. There's an editor.
At the Cal State East Bay campus in Hayward, student Philip Davis tells us he gets his news online from Yahoo.com. He calls the idea of reading an actual newspaper old-fashioned.
I mean, I notice a lot of people on my block get the paper. I'm not sure if they read it or not, but maybe they just get the paper out of habit.
Business major Kiana Brown from Oakland says she gets her news from television and online at sites like MSN.com. She can't remember the last time she actually bought a newspaper, but she admits she takes a look now and then.
Like, we see the headlines, or we see, like, the latest Britney Spears, article or whatever, but there's probably some things out there that they're missing, like a lot of local, you know, community-based stuff that we're probably missing out on because of layoffs.
She may not be a big newspaper consumer. Still, she thinks it would be sad if newspapers just faded away.
My grandparents read the papers and stuff, so, you know, older people kind of look forward to having the paper delivered. They go get the paper and have their breakfast. So I guess that would affect the older community.
At Brooks Ranch Restaurant, just south of Fresno, retired Air Force man Rob Carrier of Merced says he keeps up on the world with Fox TV. But for community news?
I get the Merced Sun Star. I do that because I need local news. If you go on the internet, it's really there's not enough information in there. So I would not like it if the newspaper closed, the local newspaper.
We talked with dozens of people throughout the state. We noticed that many of them said more or less the same thing. I don't read newspapers much, but I think they're important, and it would be a bad thing if they died, even though I'm not really sure why. Nothing wrong with nostalgia, but it'll take more than that to keep newspapers alive and well. Wallace Stegner belongs in the pantheon of writers who chronicled and celebrated the American West. At Stanford University in the 1950s and 60s, Stegner was also a teacher and mentor of aspiring writers, including Larry McMurtry, Wendell Berry, and Ken Kesey. This weekend in Marin County, a literary conference celebrating Stegner's work takes place in Point Reyes Station. Writer Philip Fradkin helped create the event, and he's also author of the new biography, Wallace Stegner and the American West. Fradkin says Stegner was also an environmentalist, but only reluctantly.
He only really wanted to be a novelist. In order to be a novelist, he had to teach. So he taught. He taught at University of Utah, University of Wisconsin, Harvard, Breadloaf, and then he came to Stanford in 1945 and founded a very, very famous creative writing program. And then his friend Bernard DeVoto said, well, you have to do something about the land and the water where you live in the mid-1950s. So he got involved in conservation, and along with Alfred Knopf and David Brower, the Sierra Club, they published This Is Dinosaur. It was the first Sierra Club book. The first national parks in Alaska were discussed when he was the chair of the National Parks Advisory Board. But all these activities took him away from his first love, and that was writing. So he was always somewhat reluctant.
He comes to Stanford in 1945, starts this now renowned creative writing program. What was it about him and his style as a teacher and a mentor of writers that connected him so much to these students?
Well, he was very understanding, and he was very kind, and in a way, a gentle way, he was very demanding, and he was always a quiet presence, and when he spoke up, people listened to him very carefully, and they respected him because he wrote, and this wasn't the case with a lot of people who taught writing at that time or maybe at the present time. Not only did he write, but he wrote very successfully. He bridged the gap between writing life and the academic life, and he showed others how they could bridge that same gap, and he was a pioneer in that way.
He was at Stanford in the 60s at a very turbulent time. The anti-war movement was happening, feminism, the hippie movement, and he became disillusioned with Stanford and with California. What was it about that environment that he was in that he found so deplorable or uncomfortable for him?
Despair starts in the late 1960s when the student revolution begins, and he sees this wonderful university become a plywood university because they don't repair the windows once they're broken. He sees classrooms disrupted. He looks on these privileged youths, these rich youths, and wonders what is in their minds when he had to scramble for an education in the Depression years. So he wants out, and he gets out in 1971, and he begins writing, and he writes his Pulitzer Prize-winning Angle of Repose, and he writes his National Book Award-winning The Spectator Bird, and he watches the West deteriorate into the geography of despair. He watches the land around him, Los Altos Hills, Silicon Valley, grow up into sort of this hodgepodge of development and in-migrating population that sort of crowds him out. And in the end, he couldn't deal with change.
There is a lot in this book about Wallace Stegner, the person, someone you call Wally, and virtually everyone calls Wally, sort of a less, much less formal sense of him than we get from his name and his reputation. Was he a hard person to find as a human being, as a man?
Wallace Stegner had a lot of guilt, and that stayed with him throughout his life. He tried to exorcise that guilt in his writing. He had a hatred of his father. He could never rid himself of that. He had an obsessive love, Oedipal, he admitted, for his mother. He could never actually deal with that. So guilt stayed with him through his whole life. And as a result, he does put up these defenses around himself. But I think altogether what comes out from White Portrait is a much more human, and I think in that way accessible human being than had previously been known.
Philip Fradkin, his new book is called Wallace Stegner and the American West, and he'll be participating in that literary conference celebrating the work of Wallace Stegner this weekend in the Marin County town of Point Reyes Station. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
For inmates at San Quentin Prison, a trip to the theater is, of course, out of the question. But there is an Arts in Corrections program there, and this week, Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing was performed for prisoners by prisoners. The cast of inmates and Marin Shakespeare Company members has been rehearsing the play since August. Reporter Judy Campbell caught the show and files this report.
Come, Balthazar! We shall hear that song again!
The actors in this stripped-down production are on an improvised stage in the San Quentin Chapel. There's no stage lighting, costumes, or maybe a hat or a sash over prison blues. But the audience of about 300 inmates is rapt, watching a scene very unlike prison life.
I pray thee, sing, and let me woo no more.
Sigh no more, lady, sigh no more.
That's Ronan Holmes in For Life or Second Degree Murder, singing in one of several of his roles in Shakespeare's comedy. He and 10 other inmates have practiced for months for this, their only performance. Holmes also plays the story's villain, Don John, a schemer and manipulator bent on breaking up the impending marriage of the romantic leads.
Therefore, I have decided not to sing in my cage.
If I had a mouth. Everybody.
Holmes adds a bit of the class clown to the role.
Ah,
it's a role he says he developed with the coaching of a professor, a Shakespeare expert, who came to San Quentin and helped him understand his character.
He's this misunderstood, angry, pissed-off half-brother of a prince. When she defined that for me, I had to change him from an evil guy to a child. He's not thinking about the repercussions of what he does. He's just doing it. And I relate to that because when I did what I did 14 years ago, I'll be damned if I was thinking about prison or anything else.
Holmes says prison is about putting up barriers, but acting is about breaking them down. Many of the actors said usually in prison you see one side of a person, the tough side. But while getting to know each other in rehearsals, they saw multiple sides. Holmes says he hangs out with the actors, who are inmates of all races. That's a rare thing in prison, and they even practice their lines out in the yard.
People have comments all the time, you know. I mean, they take a look at me and they see me hanging out with the black guys and Spanish guys, you know, and I'm white. And they're like, hey, man, you know, what are you doing? I said, I'm doing Shakespeare. And you'd be surprised how many inmates that are stone-cold racists will go, Shakespeare? Oh, yeah, okay. Well, that's all right.
The play, Much Ado About Nothing, is a comedy of mix-ups and silly antics. It's not the dark tale you might expect in prison.
They really chose it, not me. So at first I was hungry for something like Othello or we had just done Macbeth.
Soraya Keating, who works with the Marin Shakespeare Company, directed the play.
Because I think these guys really needed a kind of comic outlet for all that's going on. And it is a comedy, yet it also has some real important life themes to it.
Keating and two other actresses from the company, who were also in the cast, would show up Fridays for rehearsals. Actress Jane Dealey played Hero, a bride-to-be who was left at the altar after being falsely accused of being unfaithful.
I talked with no man at that hour, my lord.
Why, then are you no maiden?
Dealey says she was initially wary about rehearsing with convicted criminals, especially since you're so vulnerable when acting.
When you first do all those scenes where, like, okay, now you hold hands and you're in love, and it is awkward at first because walking in the first day and kind of being like, okay, we have no hostage policy, so if you get to, you know, and so it was, I think everything that happened beforehand was the most nervous part.
And soon, she says, she was very comfortable and happy to be working with some talented actors, like the inmate who plays the prince, Don Pedro.
My brother, myself, and this grief.
Don Pedro is played by Julian Pageant, another lifer. He says a lot of the scheming and manipulation found in the play, he deals with every day.
We do have to stay ahead of the next person in prison because we don't really know if this person means us well or means us harm. There's so many themes in Shakespeare that helps me in life get through this prison experience. The instances in play where there's the deceitfulness, the conniving, and then there's the realization of love and stuff like that, it helps. It helps us get through this a lot.
The realities of prison life also entered the play when sentries lead some characters off the stage. They yell,
"Escort!"
Escort. That's what guards in prison yell when they move an inmate, and the audience of inmates loved it.
I haven't seen Shakespeare for a long time. It's wonderful to see it, and they're doing such a good job.
Mitch Jones, who's been locked up for nearly 3 years for embezzlement, sighed, laughed, and gasped at twists and turns of plot. He says it makes you feel like you're not in prison anymore.
You're in Italy or wherever they're at. Yeah, I know. You're on a stage in England someplace. Yeah. So it really is transporting because it just takes the misery out of it.
Important, he says, because except for times like these, prison is mostly miserable. For the California Report, I'm Judy Campbell.
Across the bay from San Quentin, the former prison on Alcatraz is a lot less miserable than it used to be.
And welcome to the island. As you get off the boat, just stop right here on the dock for just a minute.
A national park ranger greets a group of tourists as they step off the ferry from San Francisco onto Alcatraz. Every year, over 1 million people visit this tiny island. The former maximum security prison here housed convicts like Al Capone and Robert the Birdman Stroud. But these days, some people are coming to the island not to walk through cold prison cells, but rather to garden. The gardens of Alcatraz flourished when it was a military fort in the 1900s and after it became a prison in the 1930s. Prison staff, families, and inmates worked together to cultivate a lush landscape.
One thing about humans is they have this desire to beautify their living conditions. And you can imagine when the army was out here, then it was really just a rock, very inhospitable.
Dick Miner is a volunteer with the Alcatraz Historic Landscape Restoration Project. When the prison closed down 40 years ago, the gardens turned to weeds. Now, Miner and restoration specialists are digging through archival materials to revive the gardens that once thrived here. On this clear and sunny morning, a bell tolls on a nearby buoy. With the sweeping Golden Gate Bridge behind them, volunteers rake the soil, others crouch down, weeding the pathways.
They discovered that this side of the island doesn't get wind. It's a nice place to plant.
Miner's beige hat shades his face from the sun as he points out the irises planted along a brick wall of the former army quarters. Then he moves on to the roses and honeysuckle near the tall concrete wall of what was once the inmates' exercise yard.
And all these walls have stories, and you can just feel the stories when you start getting down on your hands and knees and start getting dirty.
Over the last 5 years, the restoration project has been inspired by some of the key people who nurtured the gardens many years ago. People like Edna Swopes, the warden's wife, and inmate Elliot Michener. Both were avid gardeners. In the 1940s, Mrs. Swopes planted cutting flowers on Officers Row, while Michener worked the ornamental terraces of succulents and geraniums on the western side.
He was a very interesting man. He collected seeds from wherever he could find them. He had a passion for it, and all this developed while he was in jail. After he left prison, he actually became a landscaper on his own.
Carola Ashford is the landscape project manager.
I think it's an important story to tell of rehabilitation, for one,
for the men lucky enough to get out of the cell house and to actually be able to be creative and develop something here, of all places, in a place that really is not particularly inhabitable for men or plants. They developed something, and it was a legacy.
The buried treasures uncovered in the dirt offer even more clues to the island's secrets.
Recently we found a spoon up in the hill. So obviously this guy was planning to take the spoon and sharpen it, but realized he had to go through a metal detector and change his mind. So there's some great stories when you're working out here. Every time I find a handball, I like to think it's Al Capone's handball, but I'm sure he didn't play handball.
This spring, volunteers will begin docent tours of the gardens, and now's a great time to go because the gardens are in full bloom. For a virtual tour through the Alcatraz Gardens, past and present, check out our website at californiareport.org. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer, with additional engineering from Howard Gelman. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are Harry Gregory, Leanne Lucetta, and June Stinson, who produced our visit to Alcatraz with some help from Ali Tabatabai. Victoria Malione is our producer. We had editing help from Pat Flynn. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to turn your clocks ahead and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California. The California Teachers Association, because every child deserves a chance to learn and no child succeeds alone. More information is available at cta.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.